Hi, everybody in podcast land and also on YouTube. We're doing it. We're finally hitting the Tarantino train, and we're doing the movie that solidified him as a, generational, original talent.
Is it original, though?
Pulp Fiction.
Original talent?
He is an original talent.
Because there's a lot of references. Great artists plagiarize, great artists steal, or something. Is that what it is?
I don't think so.
Copy. Good artists copy, great artists steal.
See, I don't think it's copying. I think it's more complex than that. But we're going to get into that.
I was going to ask you your score out of 10, but instead, guys, we're going to try something different today and for the foreseeable future.
Mm.
Instead of giving ratings out of 10, we are now going to just give a more broad stroke recommendation.
Right.
Should you watch it? Should you not watch it? Should you die before you watch it? Should you watch it before you die?
Should you make someone else watch it?
Oh.
And look over their shoulder.
Hey, you watch this one for me. I'll just be popping in and out.
Provide commentary.
Sir, in the row ahead of me, can you please watch this movie? And I'll look up from my magazine across the aisle at you once in a while.
You seem to be talking a lot. Can you please pay attention? It's bothering me.
I really want to watch Blade Runner 49 on this plane screen.
And I think this makes sense because I in particular spend a lot of time trying to break down Dave's ratings. Be like, why'd you give it that extra 0.5? We can just skip that part of the discussion now because it's like the same thing every podcast.
Well, exactly. We want to focus on the actual meat of what we're saying and not get caught up on what that means in terms of scoring.
And right. What it means to have two decimal places.
Yeah, who cares?
But maybe, did we talk about this? Sometime in the future, we have a ratings episode where we just like...
Yeah, I think that'd be
interesting. We only do ratings?
Yeah, once a quarter, once a month or something. We just, at the end of an episode, we'll just do all our ratings for all the movies.
Once a year?
What's the point of that? Who wants to listen to that?
David does.
I don't care about that.
That's what I'll listen to.
David, you just
times.
Post your thing on Medium or something. We can have a David rating blog.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, that said, should we do our ratings?
All that said, David, what do you give this movie?
I give it a definite watch. This is a long slogan, so snuggle up. I once struggled to grasp my feelings on Pulp Fiction. Because on an emotional and intellectual level, I'm deeply torn.
This is a treatise, not a capsule review.
Slogan?
On one hand, it succeeds fully as a masterpiece. Its sexy left foot, fully immersed in the realm of fun and entertainment, is a snappily written, exciting look behind the curtain of the world of movies' criminal underbelly. However, its other foot, shrunken and misshapen,
what the hell are you?
Big toe cautiously dipped into the realm of the philosophical highbrow and conceptual ideas of film and storytelling, seems fully unable to pull the trigger on being a more challenging intellectual film that really makes me appreciate Tarantino in the way that maybe he and the film deserves.
Wow.
Basically, the presentation of this film is extraordinary, but its thematic ideas are average.
Yeah. We could have gotten into that in the actual discussion, but hey, you wrote a whole thing. That's cool.
Yeah.
Are you jealous that I get to write the synopses? So then you wanted to kind of...
Yeah, exactly.
You can write one.
No, I don't want to do that.
I don't want to get too into it, but I think I mostly agreed with almost everything you said there. You want to hear what I think about the movie, James?
Your derivative thoughts? You clone?
Pulp Fiction is a must watch if you've got 2.5 hours set aside to be simultaneously entertained and confused, which we'll get into because that's basically what David was talking about.
Confused. Interesting. Okay. I think if you're... Not even a cinephile, if you're a movie buff, this is on your list of movies to watch before you die. You should definitely watch this. If you liked any Tarantino movie ever, you have to watch Pulp Fiction. This is a definitely watch from James. My capsule review slogan thing is, it just isn't a complete breakfast unless your juice has pulp.
Okay. That's just, you just stole from the Breakfast Club for that one. All your slogans are going to be breakfast themed from now on.
They're all breakfast themed.
If this was a waffle... It would be a pancake.
Hey, you had that Flapjacks review slogan thing before. It was a disaster.
Yeah, that was for the Breakfast Club.
Get out of here.
Well, should we start with stuff that we like about the movie?
No, we should start with the synopsis.
Uh-huh. Oh. Hitmen Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield are sent to retrieve an important briefcase for their boss, Marcellus Wallace. No one knows what's inside, but it's definitely shiny. Vincent later must also show Mrs. Wallace a good time while her husband is out. Meanwhile, prize fighter Butch Coolidge is paid by Wallace to take a dive, but wins his fight instead, accidentally killing his opponent. He tries to flee town, but not before getting his great-grandfather's lucky golden ass watch. These four seemingly unrelated stories are interwoven in a non-linear fashion, leaving the audience asking, what in the Sam hell they just watched? Or that was me anyways. And you could kind of tell that from my recommendation.
Yeah, I sensed that. And I'd like to scrutinize that right after this message from our sponsor, Private Internet Access, the VPN that I use on my PC at my home, where my wife and child live. I use it to hide my true IP address so that I can bypass your restrictions and censorship. And it lets me connect up to 5 devices at once and includes an internet kill switch. Riley!
I wasn't prepared!
Too late if your VPN gets disconnected involuntarily. PIA is available for Windows, Mac, Android, iOS, and even as a Chrome extension, so check it out at lmg.gg/carpoolpia so you don't have to screw around anymore and you just have a VPN. It's the one to get.
Might as well have one.
It helps me.
So the reason I think I was like confused by this movie is because I agree that it's a must watch simply because of the place that it holds in, you know, cinema history at this point. But it's like I'm forced to respect it. I'm forced to appreciate it, but I don't love it as a movie watching experience.
See, that's how I feel about Tarantino in general, is that because he's so well respected, if you don't like his movies, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
But I do feel like this movie lives up to the hype and deserves all the praise that it gets.
I think this movie is awesome. You were not gripped the whole way? Well, at least like the first hour and a half, like it's gripping.
I was I will say the first like half hour, I was like, all right, yeah, we're getting into it. There's a sense that this is leading somewhere. And so I'm like, ooh, I want to see where it leads. And then as things go on, it's kind of like, oh, this isn't really leading anywhere. It's just kind of like a bunch of things that are happening. And I get that, you know, that's part of the point of the movie, and we can talk more about that later. But I think what that adds up to for me as a subjective experience, I'm like, when are we going to get to, what's the point? Like, what am I supposed to take away from this? I know that I'm the guy who only wants to talk about the takeaways, but like, I like there being kind of a coherent singular plot thread as well, and this one doesn't really have a lot of that.
We should get to that, but first, why don't we just focus on stuff that we do like?
Sure.
Yes.
Right off the top, I have a bunch of notes just from the beginning of this movie.
Heck yeah, give it to me.
It's so sweet. Like, you enter in with this like monologue at this breakfast. Actually, a quick little note. One of the first thing you actually hear, the first audio in this movie is motorcycle noise, and that is actually the sound of Butch's motorcycle, the chopper, Zed's chopper, that Butch is riding away on. In chronologically, the final scene of the movie.
Oh.
If the movie were to be presented chronologically, the first scene would be the monologue from Christopher Walken talking about this watch that he wore in his ass for four years. And then it would end with Butch riding away on the motorcycle. So anyway, they put that sound of the motorcycle at the very beginning. You hear that as we're shown the diner scene.
Yep.
And then they have that interesting conversation about holding up a place with just using a cell phone instead of a gun, which is kind of outdated now. Doesn't age too well. But then I think it's so sick that like it just evolves into, we're going to rob this place right now.
Yeah.
And then it freeze frames after that psycho chick yells out, I'm going to execute every one of you.
Yeah.
And then it freeze frames, then just hits with the sickest opening credits music.
Oh, wow. He had it ready.
Black Eyed Peas, motherfucker.
Black Eyed Peas.
Who knew Quentin was a fan of the Black Eyed Peas?
It was a shameful moment for me to realize that I'm like, oh no, I only know this song from the Black Eyed Peas remix. Whoopsies. Failed in my education there.
I don't love that partway through the title sequence, they switch songs. I feel like just stick with the one song.
Well, I guess the opening credits were so long.
Yeah, they were.
But
I kind of like it though.
It's such a minor nitpick. We'll get into nitpicks.
No, but there's a strength to that nitpick, which is this. The switch songs by hearing like a staticky radio dial switches the song, and that tells us we're in a car. And when those opening credits end, we are in a car. So I like that.
Right. I know. I was going to say I like that it kind of like gives you an indicator that you're switching tacks now. I liked that opening scene as well. Mostly because I liked that it was a couple robbers moralizing about what's wrong with society, where like no one robs restaurants.
Yeah,
they're like, what the heck? Like, why don't more people do this? It makes sense. Like, come on.
Well, Tarantino said that he likes crime movies because they're kind of like a bizarro world take on the American dream.
Mm.
And so he says that whenever he writes crime, he always has to have a commentary on American culture because that's kind of what crime movies should be. Right. So that's why he includes stuff like that.
Right.
It really sets the tone for the movie in terms of like, get ready for some N-words, because at the first scene, there's no N-words in the first scene, but Tim Roth's character, I guess that's Pumpkin.
Pumpkin, yeah.
That's what he's credited Pumpkin. With. He says Jew, Wetback, and Gook all in that first scene. Ooh. It's like, okay, strap yourselves in. And maybe that was just okay in 1994. But.
Well, that's what I'm wondering about. I'm like, wait, so it was it okay? I mean, I know it was a crime movie and people are, you know, being edgy, but like, I don't think people were walking around saying the N-word.
Definitely
even
not.
In the 90s.
It's
right?
Edgy, and that's the point. This movie is like really edgy. And I think that's the strength of it, is that it nails its tone of being kind of like half irreverent satire of the crime genre, but also being like full-on shocking, violent, racist, like crazy stuff happening. And it kind of nails the balance between the two, and I think that's why people like it.
I bet there was more N-words in the 90s.
For sure. I it's got to be. That's 25 years
like
ago
you
now.
You had... Black people saying it like all the time. Like you watch like Eddie Murphy Raw and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And like I believe like Sam Jackson's character in this movie.
Oh, totally.
Like I believe that they're just saying it in common parlance all the time.
It's not them that it's not the black characters that make me feel weird about it. It's all the white characters who say
it. I think there's
seemingly
only,
completely nonchalantly.
Well, I think there's only two white characters who say it. One being that I think his character's name is Maynard. In the pawn shop, and he's like a pedophile rapist dude.
Right.
So when he says it, I believe like he's racist and would like his daddy lynches people. Like
totally.
He's a brutal dude. And the second person who says it is the character that Quentin Tarantino plays.
Jimmy,
who is a white guy. And this is so weird because okay, here's the thing that's weird about it. First of all, Quentin Tarantino wrote it. And then he's playing it. So then it makes you wonder, did he write it because he wants to say it?
For sure.
Although I do know that he originally planned on playing not that character. He planned on playing the drug dealer character in the needle scene.
Oh.
But he didn't play that character because he wanted to be behind the camera during that scene because it's such an intense and wacky scene. Whereas the Jimmy scene, the camera movement's like really simple. But then... another angle to it is there's like kind of a hypothetical that Jules says, like, what happens if Jimmy's wife Bonnie comes home and they see us carrying this body? And in that little hypothetical, Bonnie is black. So that means Jimmy is married to a black woman. So does that mean Jimmy has a free pass on saying the N-word?
I certainly think Tarantino thinks so.
Maybe
I definitely get
how,
the idea.
Maybe that's how he justified
yeah,
it.
Did he?
Well, I don't know.
There's have you seen
could be.
Have you seen I think the consensus is that Tarantino like really would love to be an honorary black man.
I that makes a lot of sense to me.
Have you seen the videos of him? If he goes on like a press circuit promoting one of his films and he gets featured on like black television or black media outlets and he's like on a panel with all black people, he puts on like this brother voice, the Tarantino brother voice. Have you seen this?
All right, hey, download this. I don't know how to do that. All right, you know, so he put it on a cassette tape. Then Jamie, my man, all right, goes to the BET Awards, comes back with Rick Ross. Rick Ross and the whole posse. We all got contact high on the set that day. The whole MG. Oh.
Well, I was thinking about this while I was watching this movie. Like, Quentin Tarantino has a lot of, like, I don't know how to say it. But, like, it's almost like Quentin Tarantino is trying to make movies... also for black people?
I think he wants to make movies like the movies he really likes. And when he grew up watching movies, he loved blaxploitation movies.
Right.
Like he loves Shaft and stuff like that. And he wants to make movies like that, but it's not his voice. But I think he does. I mean, I'm a white dude, but I think he does a pretty good job of like, I've heard Samuel Jackson say, for example, when defending, you know, the question of whether or not Tarantino's racist, Sam Jackson said, all the characters I've played in Tarantino movies have always been like the smartest character in the movie, the people who know what's going on, and you couldn't write that if you were racist. And he's also known for his realistic dialogue. So if you take those two things together, I think he's doing a pretty good job writing black characters, is he not?
I think he is doing a really good job, but I think that's what maybe rubs me the wrong way about Tarantino. I probably wouldn't want to spend time with him. Back to Jimmy for a second. That seemed so weird to me. It's such like a weird like film school reject sort of... like, ooh, I have all these cool people in my movie and I want to be in the cool place with them too.
My guess is it played better in 1994 when we didn't know what Tarantino looked like quite as well. Now he's such a celebrity and he's a meme. He's so much that it's very distracting when you see him in the movie.
You know what? Yeah. I totally get that because knowing that that's Tarantino, I'm like looking at his acting even more.
Totally.
Especially he's in the room with John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, who are like just killing
it. And Harvey Keitel.
Yeah, who are killing it. And then like Quentin Tarantino just seems like he's shifty-eyed, and it's like you're clearly just thinking about your lines the whole time.
I know, my coffee's delicious.
Yeah, yeah. But I think if you didn't know what he looked like, you'd just be like, oh, this is a weird, creepy guy.
Yeah.
I think he delivers some of his lines okay, but then he does what I think a lot of actors do when they're amateur is like they just rely on intensity, and he just like, he starts yelling a lot, and those lines don't really land.
Totally.
But he does an okay job, but he's definitely the weakest actor in the movie. And when he spends so much time casting and getting these awesome roles for these awesome characters out of everybody, it's just kind of a shame that he should have just done that.
I think movie making for Tarantino is a bit of an ego thing, and not even in a bad way. And so I think it's important for him to be part of his movies.
And why not, man? Yeah. He's having a ton of fun making these movies. And part of the fun.
I think that he knows that those scenes maybe are kind of awkward. And so... I feel like he's done them less and less. He still will show up in his movies from time to time,
but it'll be like
a very small part. And this one was like probably one of the more substantial director acting roles that I've seen.
I certainly like him better here than I do in From Dusk Till Dawn, when he gets to. He probably made this happen, but he puts Selma Hayek's foot in his mouth.
Oh my god!
That's weird.
That's another thing you guys got to know about QT. He has a foot fetish.
Yeah. Okay. What's that shot in the taxi? Bruce Willis' character Butch is escaping from the rigged boxing match. He jumps out of a window, goes into a taxi, and there's kind of like noir shots of the taxi driver. He's got her eyes.
Her name is Esmeralda Villalobos.
She's a beautiful woman, but they show her foot and it's barefoot. And I'm like,
she's driving barefoot, baby.
I'm like, is that a character thing or is that a Tarantino thing?
It's both. He made it a character thing. Well, okay, the character Esmeralda Villalobos is taken from something else, like a different movie. Yep. She played, the character is a maid who cleans up after murder scenes. Like, so if the mob like whacks somebody in a hotel room, she cleans up after.
Nice.
And so Tarantino saw that and thought that was cool. So he took that same actor and character and integrated her into the Pulp Fiction universe.
What movie was that character in?
Don't quiz me, dude. I don't know.
It wasn't a Tarantino movie.
No. It's not.
That's Scott so Pilgrim interesting. Scott Pilgrim. Yeah.
But what other foot shots are in this movie? There's
some Uma Thurman foot shots.
When she's dancing.
Yeah.
There's there's got to be a YouTube video like cataloging
there's
all the foot shots.
Somewhere.
There's a lot of foot shots in Death Proof, which I just watched. Oh. There's a bunch of walking shots. He does a lot of these in Kill Bill too. Walking shots where the camera's right behind the feet and you're walking through some kind of space. But then there's also like feet on the dash and on the glass. Yeah. He does that in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well.
Yeah, the girl's feet. It's weird.
All right, let's get back to maybe talking about this.
So
the movie.
I can talk a little bit about how he wrote this movie, because I was curious. I was like, did he actually write this as a nonlinear story, or did that kind of happen in editing? Mm-hmm. And it happened in writing, because he...
I think so.
I
think so, too.
I definitely flubbed that up. But what he wanted to do is he wanted to take cliche stories and kind of break them down and do that. And so the first story was the Vega taking Uma Thurman's character out for dinner first. And he had that story before Reservoir Dogs.
Oh.
And then he wrote the Butch stuff.
Yeah, so in Reservoir Dogs, the Vegas they're kind of in the Reservoir Dogs universe too, right?
Yeah, there's a Vega that's supposed to be Vincent Vega's brother. And there was going to be a movie, like a prequel with both of them before, but they were too old to make it look young. So
I didn't even know that those movies were linked.
Apparently every Tarantino movie can be linked. Like the Samurai Sword, some say that it's like Hattori Hanzo?
Oh, Hanzo Sword?
Hanzo Sword.
I mean, you could do stuff like that.
From Kill Bill. And there's kind of like little connections between little character bits. And I couldn't name them. Maybe one of you in the comments can do that. But he wanted to take that. So he then did the boxer story and then kind of the other story. And so at that point, it was going to be a linear sequence of events. But he had a hard time being like, oh, I'm going to have to introduce new characters like an hour into the movie. But then he saw like, if I start tying those characters into that, I can recycle those characters and have them play into each other's story. And so he had it all intertwined and then eventually kind of shaped into the nonlinear story that we see and into the brilliant script that won an Oscar.
You get some extra bonus points when you make it nonlinear, because a lot of what makes a good script is information flow, like what questions do I have? And the fact that it's nonlinear actually raises new questions. So the first scene that we see with Butch when he's talking to Marcellus Wallace in the bar, near the end of that scene, Travolta, which is Vince Vega and Jules, enter the bar and they're wearing these like dork outfits, right? They're wearing just like casual clothes, shorts and t-shirts. And so far in the movie, we've only seen them wear like their Reservoir Dogs.
Well, they're
like,
Blues
suits.
Brothers suits. Yeah.
Blues Brothers suits. And so you're kind of just like, why? Why are they wearing that? It's a little question mark there.
Yeah.
But then you also lose some stuff, too, because I think if you put this movie linearly, you would be like, what's the character arc here? Like, who is learning new things to overcome some kind of weakness?
Well, I think that's my problem, because if you do put it linearly, the theme is primarily choice and consequence of choice. And the main spot to see that is the difference between Vincent Vega and Jules, where they both experience the same thing and they have a different reaction or a different consequence as it. Jules realizes, wow, I didn't get shot. That means that there's a miracle. I need to get out of this. Whereas Vincent Vega is like, that's just chance, whatever, who cares? One dies, one we don't know what happens to. He shows up as the Drifter in another Tarantino movie.
Some say that that Rufus, the Drifter in Kill Bill,
that's it.
Is Jules. Yeah. I don't really dig it. He kind of talks differently.
It's okay.
He says he was a musician and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but it's one of those things like the sword. You could say it fits.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun. I like that kind of stuff. And so I say that's the primary theme. And everything is about choice and consequence and things happening by chance or by destiny.
That's what I was going to say is the main theme and for
totally.
Me is like, is life chaos or is there meaning?
And when you play it out linearly where it's like, okay, you have two characters and same thing happens and they have opposite reactions. So you can kind of compare and contrast the theme through that lens.
Right.
It's really simple, but you're right. When you take it out of order, it kind of raises more question and adds like a little more depth to it maybe. Or does it just leave enough room for interpretation that we interpret more depth?
I definitely appreciate that this was presented non-linearly because, as you say, if it was linear, it would be, I think, less interesting because I'd be looking for a character arc more. And I think that the way that it is right now, although maybe that would have made it better for me because that whole, like, it was a miracle, it wasn't a miracle thing chronologically happens early. But in the actual movie, it happens near the end.
Yeah.
So
if that happened right at the beginning, I'd be like, okay, cool. There's some meat here. There's something to keep in mind as we see these later things. I want to see how one character reacts and the other one reacts a different way. But as it was, I think that the theme wasn't really presented until later in the movie.
I can agree with that, yeah.
So then it's like I spent, you know, 3/4 of the movie just kind of being like, ugh. Why am I watching this?
Yeah.
You know, what's the point?
Because there's a bunch of interesting vignettes.
Yeah,
and they stand alone.
I agree. Like, and I think like the writing of this film is so fun, so snappy, and like
it's
so clever. And like I love in the first scene they're talking about burgers, and the next scene they're eating burgers, and like the little call outs, and it's about there's like the little clever things. In that same vein that you're saying, the cleverness serves the dialogue and like the delivery of it. It doesn't ever serve the theme. And I think that's a mistake that they don't use the dialogue to set up bigger ideas. They're using it to be really clever and set up payoff in an entertaining way.
I do set up story with it. Like, for example, the foot massage thing at the beginning. Again, that whole thing.
Totally.
That's another Tarantino thing. He wrote a story about a foot massage.
Oh, my God.
So, but that whole foot massage story is all to set up Marcellus Wallace.
Yep.
Right.
You know, he's the kind of guy you don't want to be on his bad side because he'll throw you out a window just for giving me a foot massage.
But then you find out maybe that wasn't true.
Maybe it wasn't
true. Yeah, I like that.
And I like that you don't really know. Like, you kind of get the idea that, it was exaggerated, but maybe not.
For all my problems that I had with kind of the structure of the movie and the lack of thematic content until later, it's unquestionable that the dialogue in this movie is freaking stellar. It's like clever without being too clever. Like, people will kind of like get into kind of like a philosophical question. I mean, quote unquote philosophical, like, are foot massages
sexual,
intimate or not? And then right before it kind of gets like too heady, someone will say something stupid and kind of like bring it back to reality. And you're like, oh, this could be a real conversation.
I like how that culminates where Travolta's like, I've given a million foot massages. Every one of them meant something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Jules is kind of like, hey, maybe, I don't know. And then he's like, would you give a dude a foot massage?
Yeah.
And he just silent. Fuck you.
And
so that's great dialogue because we know, like, we're just following along. Like, oh, he has him now. That's a good point. Like, we're invested. We're thinking about our own opinions on the matter. Like, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Another thing that was cool about that part, they have that conversation when they're walking up to the building, but then they get to the door and it looks like they're going to enter. And we don't even know why they're there, right? They have this conversation. Sometimes on their approach, they're like pausing just to keep talking. But then they get to the door of the apartment and they're like 10 minutes early or something like that. So then they go and continue the conversation. But it's good filmmaking because they could have just had the whole conversation and then went to the door.
Right.
But they don't. They break it up to remind you like something's going to happen in there. You don't know what it is yet.
Yeah.
But just to keep the tension high, right?
I do feel like this movie is slightly, very slightly self-indulgent where it's so interested in giving us a snappy dialogue that sometimes it sacrifices pacing and story in order to give us that.
What parts of the movie do you feel that?
I think that scene in particular, but the one that really sticks out to me is the hotel scene. The motel scene when Butch. I can't, I always think he's Bucky. I always think it's Bucky. Butch.
Butch!
Butch.
So anyways.
Butch.
You can't say it! Is this a French thing?
Butch.
Booch.
Yeah, Booch. From now on, just call him Booch.
And his partner, who strangely looks like an 11-year-old boy.
that's a French lady, dude.
Yeah, sure.
Fabienne.
So there's the first scene, he arrives at the hotel. She's already asleep, and they kind of have this discussion. They establish the relationship, kind of the dynamic they have, that she knows what's going on, and they're going to have to get out. And then it wakes up the next morning, and they're having fun. They're doing that. And then it fades to black. And then there's a third scene. And I think that that scene, or those, that series of scenes could have been condensed.
100%.
So much.
100% agreed.
See now?
That was like the first slowdown in the movie for me. I was like, all this interesting stuff happened. We just came off the Mia Wallace like heroin injection scene. And then you have like an extra scene there.
Yeah.
Where like he comes home. Happen. That's good. Then they're brushing their teeth. That's okay. And then you get kind of more of the same in the morning.
Yeah.
Unnecessary.
I think I completely agree with you that it's self-indulgent and that it has an effect on the pacing. But and I think that is also why it kind of, a lot of these scenes rubbed me the wrong way, where I'm like, get to the point. What are we doing here? But I will again say, I watched some YouTube analyses and something was pointed out to me that I was like, oh, okay, maybe I appreciate it a bit more now, because all of that sort of slow dragging things out, having these long, you know, in some cases they're philosophical conversations, in other cases they're just like dicking around and doing nothing, and then at the culmination of those scenes there's like a big impact, there's like some explosive event that cuts through it. And I feel like those kind of like slow sequences serve to build you up and kind of lull you into this sense of comfort and, you know, ease, and then boom, something crazy happens. So like in the hotel room, for example, they're having that whole thing, and then he finds out that she forgot the watch, and he just explodes, and then we feel like, whoa, this is crazy. And we feel the effects of that, because we feel the tension and the weight of that, because, you know. Because
we know their relationship's good. We know he's not a dickhead.
Yeah, yeah.
We've seen enough of them just being playful and
they
loving
each other. They were
chilling. Yeah.
Another moment where I think this film is not efficient with its storytelling is when they first arrive at, what is it, Slim Jim's?
Jackrabbit Slim's.
Jackrabbit Slim's.
Yeah.
Which is an excellent set. And apparently it's the most expensive set in the film. And you can
it
tell.
It was the biggest line item on the on their whole budget,
I think. It's gorgeous. And it's so cool. Like, as soon as I see it again, I'm like, I want to go there. I would love to be in
there. You can't go there. The exterior was an old bowling alley. The interior was completely built and it's now, still stands. It's owned by Disney.
Oh.
Well, I don't know if the interior like looks like that, but it's a stage.
I guess, yeah, because Disney bought Miramax, right? Oh, hurts. And Weinstein Company. Anyways, what my problem is with the intro of that scene, and I'm sure there's lots of justifications, like he's on heroin and it's this, but it takes its sweet-ass time getting you to the table, and it doesn't make sense the way they go. They go, like, if it's a full 360... And they go basically like 3 degrees of distance, but they go the full 360 so you can get a full visual of the whole thing. And I think in a more efficient film, they would have kind of more than just showing you the space and what it's like. They would give you kind of like a dialogue moment or like a thematic moment inside of that space.
Okay.
Like one other purpose for that big
360. Because I was going to push back and say like, dude, like what's the purpose of a movie? Like, if it's to capture my imagination, I want to be in Jackrabbit Slim. Totally. So I love that I'm getting taken around, and I wish I could go to that restaurant.
That Marilyn Monroe is unreal.
So you're not saying no to that. You're just saying that plus.
That plus.
Like, and if you're going to do that, use it.
Yeah, and this movie overall is so great that we have to focus in on the little things, because, like, it's a masterpiece. And so I have to kind of focus in on, like, little things that bother me, and that's just a little thing.
You just touched on something I really thought was cool and that I like. There's a right before that, when he goes and picks her up, he shoots up. He goes to his dealer's place and he buys this really badass heroin, and then he shoots up, and it's like there's a lot of these macro shots of getting all the paraphernalia prepped and all that, and it almost seems like it's glamorizing drug use a little bit. But then I realized that we need to see this entire sequence of how heroin is used. We need to see it so that later on, when we see Mia who has been using cocaine a bunch, and we're showing how she uses that with her nose right on the counter of the bathroom beside everybody else.
Yeah.
We know now, even if we have no exposure to drugs, we know heroin's taken this way and cocaine's taken that way. And Vince Vega does heroin and Mia Wallace does coke.
And when
she finds that heroin and she takes it the coke way, that's bad. And now that's all set up.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that we kind of get that context of she's doing it the wrong way by the way that the Mia scene is shot. He's in the bathroom. She's alone. She's dancing around by herself. You know, she's already done some drugs this evening. She sits down and now it looks like she's just going to wait for him. And then she pulls the baggie out and she's like, oh.
Hello.
And I feel like...
She looks at it for so long before she even reacts to it though, hey?
I feel like that would tell that story without the need for this. I mean,
no, there wouldn't be any suspense though. There wouldn't be, because she'd pull it out of her pocket. You'd be like, oh, she's got this white powder. And then she'd hit it with her nose. And then it would be only until her nose is bleeding that you would be like, oh, what's wrong? Why did something bad happen?
Wow.
Whereas if she holds it,
we
and
know
you
that
know
it's
that,
heroin though.
Yeah, but if you don't know how heroin's used, as she starts chopping up on the table, you're like, no.
You're saying for somebody who doesn't know how heroin's taken.
Yeah.
Ah. That's fair.
I think it's all necessary.
Do you know what's my favorite scene in this entire movie? It's when Butch escapes and you think he's going to leave. He takes a second, goes back, and he like slowly looks at the weapons. He takes the sweetest time. He's like, hammer? No.
So those are all callbacks.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. I don't know what do you know which movies they're all from?
No.
I know the baseball. He picks up a hammer.
Hammer.
He picks up a baseball bat.
Then a chainsaw.
The baseball bat's from Walking Tall.
Okay.
Not the Rock one. The like original one.
Oh.
And then he does a chainsaw.
Yeah.
What is that?
Maybe Evil Dead.
Maybe Evil Dead. And then eventually he gets the sword, which is from a Japanese movie.
He loved Kurosawa, so it could be from any of the Kurosawa films.
These are known. You can look this shit up.
No.
It is known.
It's known. We just suck.
One of the things that I think turns me a little bit off of this movie is some of the fan base. In the same way that The Shining gets the crazy analysis of like, oh, the geometry of this room means that like he's losing his mind and all this stuff. I think that this movie gets a little bit overanalyzed and people are like, he selects the katana because it is an honorable weapon and he wishes to be an honorable warrior.
He just wanted to cut somebody with a katana. It's badass.
Yeah, exactly. I think
there's another thing in that same room though. There's a neon light.
Okay.
And some of the letters are missing. Like they're burned out.
Yeah.
And the letters, I forget what the words are, but the bottom word ends in ED and it's a 3-letter word, I think. And so
erectile dysfunction.
So but Butch has just gotten the keys to Zed's motorcycle. So anyway, the like what people think is like if you take this Z from that keychain and you like put it onto the illuminated ED, then it like it completes this message. And like,
sure.
I don't think so.
See, I would understand why people want to do that stuff for Tarantino's films, though. Analyze it like crazy because he does have a lot of stuff in the background and callbacks to things. Totally. Like,
well, that's the justification that they give to Kubrick movies as well. It's just like he has a lot of intentionality with the mise-en-scene and stuff like that. So of course, this is not a coincidence.
Well, and Kubrick was also kind of insane, right? Tarantino's sort just of. Weird.
But he wasn't concerned about what kind of beans are on the shelf and what that means for Indians.
Kubrick wasn't?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah, Kubrick wasn't. Anyways.
Right. So what part do you like about that? You like that he's selecting all the weapons? Or do you like the moment that he's about to walk away and be like, screw this, I'm out of here. But then he goes,
yeah,
that's not who I am.
I went back a little bit too early. What I really love is when he goes back down and starts killing the motherfuckers.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's such a good moment when he's running for his
that's
life.
That's awesome. Because I love violence.
because he's on the run from Marcellus Wallace because he cheated the rigged game.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to get out of the city, and then all this crazy stuff happens, and they end up in this pawn shop basement where there's a racist pawn shop owner and a racist security guard. And they
Is he a cop?
I think it's a security guard on the shoulder.
Yeah, he's like a mall cop.
Yeah. And so they kidnap people and they rape them and then presumably kill them after. And they have a gimp that's like in a coffin or something and they open it up and the gimp's just there and it's hilarious.
The gimp.
No, it's not hilarious. It's disturbing.
So
this movie is really interesting because it's a really, on the one hand, like rated R explicit movie, but on the other hand, almost all the violence is off scene or off screen.
Well, totally. Like, even like the gunshots aren't as bloody as later Tarantino films. Like they're just like a little bit of squib.
I wonder how much of that is budget, because we do know like in Django or something, there's just blood everywhere. But in this movie, And even in Reservoir Dogs, the ear chopping scene, like, it was crazy when that movie came out. It's the only thing that people could talk about was how this guy gets his ear cut off, like dismemberment in this movie. But it's off screen. The camera just tracks away and you don't see it at all. And then in this movie, Jules, the first violence, I believe, is Jules shooting a dude who's on the couch, but you don't see any blood.
Yeah, there's
with
no
that.
Blood.
We don't see Martin get shot in the head, but we see the blood explode onto the glass.
Marvin.
We don't see.
We can just save some VFX work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just, it might be for budget.
Maybe.
I think it works, though. That scene it is kinda, very shocking.
It bothered me that when Jules shoots the guy on the couch, he shoots him in the abdomen or something, and he's just kind of like, oh.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I'm dead now.
But the thing that's interesting is the other side of that off-screen violence, which actually isn't that explicit, is the movie still was like so disturbing to me when I watched it as a probably too young teenager, because like the existence of a gimp, the existence of these guys that have a basement where they like could anally totally. Rape a big man and put ball gags are the creepiest things.
Yeah.
I hate ball gags.
Yeah.
They're so gross. And the gimp, apparently Tarantino said the backstory like that he just has in his mind is that the gimp is just some like drifter that these guys found like 7 years ago. And he's been in that locked box for that long.
That honestly terrified me, when it came out. I mean, like, I wasn't like, but I was just kind of like, oh, that is messed up.
Oh, but it feels so good when he comes back with the sword and chops the one dude, and he's like, pick up the gun.
Yeah. That is, like, a really interesting point in the plot, because I'm confused about Butch's character, you know? Like, so he's a prize fighter for a mob boss. Is he a good guy? Not really. So I'm just kind of confused about why all of a sudden he has this like moralistic streak to be like, you know what? No, I'm going to go.
I don't think
bros don't leave bros behind.
You don't have to be that good of a guy to save another dude who's getting raped like forever. Like,
yeah, but that guy was trying to kill him. He was like scot-free. Now I'm out of here. And the ending wouldn't be that different because either way, he can't return to the city.
If he's going
to
go down there, he's going to have all the power. If he's going to go down there and save the dude, save Marcellus, he's going to have the sword. Marcellus isn't going to have a sword.
Well, honestly, that's what's confused me about the ending, because he goes down and saves him, and then Marcellus comes up and he, shoots the other guy or whatever, and now Marcellus is sitting there with a shotgun. It's like, kill the guy. Kill Butch. You're a mob boss.
But I think he's
get rid of the problem.
But they have the moment where they're sitting beside each other, both bound up on chairs.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they look at each other and connect in that moment, but they've shared that experience.
Yeah, I think I would feel pretty good about the other guy who was about to get the same fate as me coming back to help me.
You would.
Yeah.
You're not a mob boss.
Yeah, but he's also these like not a guard. They don't really show us that much about him, but like what you see, he seems like a pretty reasonable dude.
What do you mean he threw the guy out the window?
No,
well,
that
we
didn't
don't,
happen.
Well, we might have. We don't know whether it did.
What
or
they
not.
Do is they set it us up at the beginning. They don't show his face. They just hear these stories of how evil he is. But the more you see him through the movie, you're like, no, he's just a regular
dude. And that one
dude.
low level drug dealer guy that Jules kills. He's like, what does Marcellus Wallace look like? He's black and he's bald. This is again back to like the foot massage thing. They build up Marcellus before you ever see him. All we know is he's black, he's bald, and he doesn't like anyone screwing him over or screwing him other than Miss Wallace.
Yeah. Speaking of Marcellus Wallace, the thing that most upsets me about the fan base in this movie, and doesn't upset me, I don't care. Is
we love you, fan base. Please don't be angry at us.
So there's the bandit on the back of his head. And so the fan base believes that. That's where Marcellus Wallace's soul has been extracted and put in the briefcase. So that's what they're seeing in the briefcase is a soul.
And I saw one explanation. It's like, because when you sell your soul to the devil, it gets extracted through your neck. I'm like, natural.
Totally. Yeah. That's
but
just
Tarantino
science.
But Tarantino has been clear and been like, no, that's not a thing. So if you believe that.
Really?
He like cut himself shaving. He shaved his head for the role. Yeah. He cut himself like on the day of shooting.
Yeah.
They put a Band-Aid on it.
And it works.
Cool.
It's cool. It's like a little bit of mystery.
Well, because and then there's also the fact that the briefcase's combination is 666.
Yeah.
And his club is bathed in red. So people are like, oh, he sold to the devil.
It's the devil. To me, it doesn't matter at all what's in that briefcase.
Yeah.
It is mildly interesting that whoever opens it like has this like, whoa, big reaction to it. I really like Honey Bunny. She's like, God damn it, what is it?
I think it's brilliant that you don't know. I think things that are open and that are satisfying in a way that you can understand the information but are open enough that your imagination can kick in.
It's because
that's
it doesn't
best.
Matter what
yeah,
it is.
That's
it
the best.
Matter.
It's something important. It. It's a MacGuffin.
It's better to be a question mark than just $1 million.
It might be the best MacGuffin ever because it's nothing, but it's everything. At
it's
the same
a MacGuffin
time.
That actually makes sense.
One thing I like is the fact that Vega shoots up heroin before he goes to Mia's place.
Right.
There's a couple questions. One is, does that mean that he's an addict? Or does it speak to how casual the use of heroin was in that milieu at that time? Because we know he cares about his job. He really is taking this seriously, the fact that he has to take the boss's wife out, right? He's kind of anxious about it. He's asking other people about it. But then he shows up high. Like, when he goes to her house, he's pretty dopey.
Super dopey.
Yeah. He's, like, trying to work the intercom. Hello? He can't do it, right? So does it... I don't think that he would do something that would jeopardize, like, his professionalism.
I think that his actions make a lot more sense to me when I view him as, like, a dopey... a dopey, like, semi-intellectual university student who's, like, thinks he's trying to think about some things deeply, right? He has a few moments in this movie where he tries to wax philosophical about something or other. But at the same time, he's kind of an idiot. Like, the wolf is like, all right, guys, let's clean up this car. Let's go. And he's like, a please would be nice. It's like, hey, idiot, just do it.
That's ego, though. That's not intelligence.
But it's no, that's what I'm saying. It's a lack of intelligence that, like, shut your mouth at this point in time.
No, but he's just he's prideful.
But he's too dumb to not be prideful. That's my whole point.
You don't get to choose that shit.
I think there's an element too of, like, as a heroin addict, he's, like, self-medicating and thinks that he's his best self with the heroin and that he's most likely to do the best chill job.
Yeah, maybe it's a downer. So maybe he's just so nervous about it that he wants to be chill when he goes in. But the thing that I like is that you can actually follow his buzz through the movie. Mm. Because by the time they get to Jackrabbit Slim's, he's a little more aware. By the time they sit at the table, he's like kind of starting to zone. Yeah. Like he's kind of hitting a good buzz level. And by the time they dance, it's perfect. He's got enough of the edge off that he can just dance.
Question for you guys. So there's a rule in storytelling, and it's like explicit in the Pixar 22 Rules of Filmmaking, is that nothing can happen by chance unless it's bad. So what do you think about, like, in this movie when things are kind of like just happening by chance and they're lucky, like Bruce Willis in his apartment and Vincent Vega comes out and there's the gun and he's just like, cool. Shoot some more, like...
Or when the shots against Vega and Winifred... Jules, they miss. The guy misses
or,
all shots.
When Bucky... Fuck, no. Butch is driving and then there just happens to be like Wallace walking across the street holding a coffee and donut.
Well, that's not good.
But it is, because then he can just run him over.
But he would rather just be driving away. That's what he thought he was doing.
So what do you think about that? Do you think that it's a thematic choice? Do you think that, like, what do you think about the fact that they kind of break that rule?
I feel like that really helps the theme of chaos versus meaning along a lot. Because I think I was confused by your question a little bit, because it's like, what do you think about these random good things that happen? And I'm like, well, because there are all these different characters, some are good and some are bad, depending on which character we're following at any given moment. So I think that kind of has something to say about the meaning that you find from the universe depends on your perspective. Like, okay, this other thing could seem like a completely random occurrence, but to somebody over there, that's the most meaningful thing that's ever happened in their life, you know? And I think that despite the misgivings I have about the structure of the plot, I like how a bunch of random stuff happens, and at the end, Jules kind of gives us this speech of, hey, you know, I thought I was a decent man or whatever, and other people were the bad guys, but turns out I'm the tyrant, and maybe I'm trying to be the shepherd now. And this is like the meaning that he's taking out of the chaos. And I liked how that was kind of crystallized in that one scene at the end in the restaurant.
One casualty of the non-chronological presentation of this movie is that it doesn't have like a linear rising action. Like if you were to graph like time and action, it wouldn't be just like a steady build like that. It would be like a camel with like three humps.
Yeah.
Because you have like the Mia stuff that's really exciting. Then that goes into like Butch and that gets really lame for a second. And then that goes like to the most exciting part of the whole movie is the sex dungeon part. Then that goes down and then doesn't build again until we're at the restaurant.
There's an interview with Tarantino where he actually said the whole movie is about the sex dungeon.
That's what I wanted to happen.
that's not true. I made that up.
I just couldn't get enough feet.
I'm thinking about making a sex dungeon movie. That's not how he'd say
that
it.
That doesn't sound like
I have a question.
I was just curious,
and there might not be an interpretation to this, but in the final scene in the diner when Jules and Vega are talking, it's kind of their most intense emotional moments. And generally in filmmaking, you would want the closest eye line. So you'd bring the camera the closest to straight on as possible. Their eye line would be directly off camera. And it kind of gives you the most amount of emotion that out of their performance. But in this movie, they choose to do so far in profile that it's almost a French over, where it's almost behind the 90-degree mark. Why do you think that Tarantino chose to do that?
Well, one's chaos and the other one is trying to bring meaning into it. Bam, bam.
Bam.
Themes.
Solved.
Why do you think, David?
Yeah.
You obviously have an answer.
No, I don't. I would say it's probably that he wants to show them as opposing forces the most. But I feel like, to me, it actually kind of diffuses the emotion of that. And like you were saying, the sex dungeon is by far the most exciting part of the movie. And I think that filmed a different way where it's trying to not visually show the theme, but to heighten the excitement, I think that scene would be a little bit better served.
Like they did in the Mia scene. Like they draw out the climactic moment of the overdose scene so well.
So
you know,
great.
He's just like, here's the needle. Here's everything you need to have happen. I'm going to count to three and then you do it. But then when he goes 3, 2, 1. When he gets to one, there's another like 10 count because like the camera zooms in on the dealer's wife's face. Then it zooms in on the tip of the needle. Then it zooms in on like the dot on her chest.
Yeah.
Then it shows Vega. It's like it's drawn out so much suspense. It's amazing. And what do you think about the fact that when they first get to the place, the drug dealer guy is running around looking for his little black medical book. And he has this big fight. Like, they're all so super stressed out. They do this thing, which I think is so realistic, where they have a totally non-material fight that's just not helping the situation.
Yeah.
Where it's like, well, where did you put it? Well, you're always putting shit everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm just trying to focus. And then it doesn't culminate at anything. He doesn't even get the book in the end. But it just makes it all so much more stressful.
I think that's what some of Tarantino's, like, it shows off his dialogue writing ability, where he can make things seem so absurd and stupid in the moment that it seems realistic. Because life isn't a movie, and it doesn't just, like, have a sequence of events that culminates in a thing that makes sense. It's just, like, a bunch of chaotic stuff.
If you reverse engineer the scene, like, let's say they have that squabble about the book just to make the scene more exciting and stressful.
Mm.
Okay. Then he has to have that squabble with somebody. So he has this girlfriend. But then the girlfriend can't just be present without an introduction, because then it would be boring. We wouldn't know who it was. It'd be lame. Kind of like that chick who's just smoking pot on the couch. We don't know who she is. She's just there, right? So then he has to introduce this character, but he doesn't want to spend time on that. But he does it so succinctly. When we are first brought to the drug dealer house, we actually hear before we see, and what we hear is that woman talking. She's giving this monologue about piercings, and it's probably like 15 seconds long, and it's not related to anything else in the movie, but it just like introduces us to her, and that's all we need to know. And then now when we see her later, we know her, and it works.
Yeah, and it just gives some ambiance. I think that's good, like when a movie can have a scene or a little monologue that seemingly plays no part in the plot, but it just kind of brings you in a little bit.
It's world building.
Yeah.
Like, world building's easier to spot in fantasy or sci-fi.
Right.
But in this, it's about like alternativeness. And she's just saying her worldview, which is that if you get pierced by a gun, that's like contrary to the whole like movement of piercing. So you're kind of just like, what? Who are these people? They just kind of opens your mind a little bit.
How do you feel about piercing with a gun, David?
It's got a nose way ring. More unsanitary.
Oh.
You should actually get pierced with the needle, not for pleasure, but because you can sanitize the needle every time. But if you get the gun, it's a bunch of shit and gunk and bacteria.
Good to know.
Wow.
I want to talk about coolness.
Oh, the guy who hates cool people. In the Baby Driver episode, you were like,
well, no. See, it's not that I hate coolness. It's that I hate coolness that doesn't really like have a purpose. Like, I don't like depicting characters in movies as cool when it's like, why should we be putting these people on a pedestal? Why are they cool? What makes someone cool? Obviously, coolness is a huge theme in a lot of Tarantino's movies because he has a lot of these iconic characters. A lot of his movies are influenced heavily by, like, you know, quote-unquote cool movies from the past, kung fu movies, blaxploitation movies, you know, World War II capers. And so this movie is undeniably cool, you know? Like, do you guys agree that it's cool? What makes it cool? What makes this movie cool? Cool, 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 cool.
I think there's a few different elements. One is the fact that, like, the dialogue is cool, and it's funny, and it's clever, and it's everything you wish you could come out of your mouth on a daily basis. You wish you could have these, like, interesting monologues or these interesting thoughts. So that's cool. I think the style is cool. The way people are
dressed.
Are you
talking about the movie or the characters, like, in the movie?
The characters first. I think that's what's cool. But, I mean, the movie is the sum total of its parts, and so the characters are one part. I think the style is cool, what the characters are wearing, but also the way it's shot, the lighting, all this stuff.
But Jules is cool, and he's just wearing, like, a monkey suit. But why is there an aspect of coolness that it has to do with power? There must be, right? Because we think Jules is cool, but one of the earliest scenes with him is just him dominating all these other people. He's standing up in this room where everyone else is seated. He's literally taking their food out of their mouth. let me eat your burger. Here, can I have a drink? Just sucks the whole thing till finish while just looking the guy right in the eyes. He just dominates him, and you think he's cool. He's got these Jerry curls.
I think power and domination is definitely a huge part of it. I mean, like, also, I think pairing two things like that together, like Jules and Vincent, you know, they're walking in, they're dressed the same, they got the same guns. They're going in and they are talking about how they're going to take care of these people. And you're just like, whoa, the synergy there, the cooperation. Friendship is cool. I think that overall for me, then the point that I was leading into with this kind of prompt was the movie seems cool, I think, because as we talked about earlier, there are these scenes that kind of are slow and things are kind of moving along and we're having a pointless conversation. And then something precise and powerful happens. And I think there's also parts in the movie where frantic things are intercut with purposefully lax, laid back things.
Like when
Vincent is driving the car with Mia to the drug dealer's house and he's like, man, I got, she's ODing in his seat. And he's like, oh, I got it. This is a huge problem. I got to figure it out. And we cut back to the drug dealer and he's just chilling, like watching
eating
some TV.
Fruit Brute, just watching game shows.
Fruit Brute.
Yeah.
That's what it's called.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. There's like a lineup of like monster cereals.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's Fruit Brute.
Yeah. He's just chilling, eating some cereal. And I think that kind of like juxtaposition makes you like, it just draws you in a little bit more, right?
There's actually one of my favorite quotes in the movie is right around that time. Because there's some huge quotes in this movie that like the medieval one.
I'm gonna get medieval on your ass.
That is huge. He didn't coin it. Apparently, like I looked into this a little bit. There were people saying like, oh, I don't want to be medieval about it, but blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That existed. Get medieval on your ass is from this movie, as far as anyone can tell.
Nice.
And that's just amazing. And you know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's going to like just straight up torture this
guy. You think about swords.
And then there's the whole Zed's dead thing.
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
The delivery, I'm not like that sold on, but it's a cool line.
Yeah, I'd never heard that line before, but I liked his delivery.
There's a band called Zed's Dead, like a DJ group. Like it's a big line.
And Led Zeppelin. Is also
what rhymes, but one of my favorite lines is from that drug dealer scene. I think it's so funny, and no one ever talks about this line.
I don't know you. Who is this? Don't come here. I'm hanging up the phone. Prank caller.
Just like, if you believe it, it's true. Prank caller. I did not receive this.
Yeah.
Then this one, I can't get this out of my head. I think about this all the time.
Walk out the door, get in the car. Go home, jerk off, and that's all you're gonna do.
That's all you're gonna
that's
do.
That's so realistic, too.
So good.
It's so realistic because it's like no one is gonna, no man whose brain's anything like mine anyway, is gonna go on this date with this woman, have all this sexual energy to the extent that he has to talk himself down and like tell himself to go home. And if he's gonna do that, and if he had that kind of night,
yeah,
he's gonna jerk off before he goes to bed.
Right. It's realistic that he would include that in his little pep talk to himself.
Very good.
Yeah.
And that's all you're going to do.
It is iconic, which brings me to something I wanted to bring up. The Bible verse that Jules recites.
Ezekiel 25:17.
But it's not a real verse.
And it's not a real verse.
Oh, why?
It's partially real.
And once I found out that it's not a real verse, I was like, oh, that adds a lot to the character.
It does.
It also adds a lot to like what I think of Quentin Tarantino. Because, so like, the whole thing is completely made up. I mean, obviously, it seems like it would be.
Yeah,
it's written in such a way that it's like, oh, that's in the style of, you know, the King James Bible or whatever. So what they say in the movie is, the last line is, and you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee. In the actual Bible verse, Ezekiel 25:17, I will carry out great vengeance on them and punish them in my wrath. Then they will know that I am the Lord when I take vengeance on them. So it's like, kind of, but the rest of the whole monologue is completely made up.
But not
made up. It's taken by, do you know what movie?
No.
It's taken by a 1976 kung fu movie called The Bodyguard, starring Sonny Chiba.
Of course.
See, I had never heard of Sonny Chiba either.
He's in Kill Bill.
Oh, is he?
I think so.
I mean, he was a star. He was a martial arts star that kind of like starred in
Kill Bill, yeah.
Kung fu movies. And the beginning of that movie has that whole monologue play out at the beginning of the movie. And it says it's from Ezekiel 25:17 again, so it's like, I guess they just made it up.
You know, but, you know who he is in Kill Bill? Who? He's Hattori Hanzo, the one who makes her sword. That's why it's so cool.
That's cool. Yeah.
To Tarantino, it's like the most badass sword on the planet gets made by the most badass action star.
That's awesome.
That he
I love
reveres.
That.
Apparently, I think Sonny Chiba showed up on the day of filming of Pulp Fiction when Sam... God, I'm so...
Samuel L. Jackson?
On the day of filming when Samuel Jackson was doing the Big Kahuna Burger, Tasty Burger scene.
Oh, yeah? Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Sick. So the reason I love that is because it told me about Quentin Tarantino and like that was one of the references. But it also kind of tells you about Jules, that he has been reciting this his entire life. Well, not his entire life, but for a long time, he's been reciting this every time he kills somebody. But it's like... It's not a real verse, so he just like, where did he come? Where did he That's hear so that was the verse? Where did he get that?
He's kind of just filling in like who he wants to be, what he wants to be true. He's making his own reality there.
Yeah, I really, and that feeds in again because he's kind of like trying to make meaning out of the chaos that it has been his life up to this point.
Do you guys think Tarantino will ever make a better movie than Pulp Fiction?
I think he already has. Well, okay, personally, that's just my preference. I like, you know, Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds better than this movie.
Really? Oh, I'm so far on the other side.
Oh, really?
I think that this is his masterpiece that he'll never succeed in defeating. Everything else after leans too much on the homage and the simple, like, visceral side of filmmaking, whereas I think this movie wasn't trying to... be anything. It was just being a good movie. It was just interesting.
Whereas, it's also like, gone like on a 3-movie stint of revisionist history.
Totally. And I think that's that's the stuff that I'm not super into. Like, I like Inglourious Basterds, but like, what's the point of Inglourious Basterds? Nazis are bad. Yep, we know that. Okay, what's the point of Django Unchained? Slavery's bad.
Yeah.
Yep, we got it. Okay, what's
Charles Manson bad?
Yeah, you got it. You figured it out. I figured out the pattern too.
I think
that's why Kill Bill is his best movie.
It's not his
Haters.
Best movie.
I forget about Kill Bill.
I like Kill Bill. But like
it is,
if I'm criticizing the thematic of Pulp Fiction, then I'm going to eat Kill Bill alive. There is no thematic. And like the first one's interesting and it's the style of it is excellent. It's such a well-styled movie, but like it's a simple samurai revenge story, but with a modern take. Like it's nothing super interesting. He's at his most remix artist, in Kill Bill, in my opinion.
I think that
things don't need to, it doesn't, there's so many different dimensions by which a movie can be awesome, and Kill Bill is definitely an awesome hero's journey movie, but it doesn't need to have complex themes. Like, take a movie like Unstoppable. There's a runaway train. It's pretty lame, but it's great execution, and it's a great movie.
I think I would agree with you there. Like, I know that Django Unchained and, what was the other one I said? Inglourious Basterds are, like, pretty simple, but I think that I like simple ideas executed really well, and I think this movie, Pulp Fiction, has maybe some complex ideas, but it's executed in such kind of a haphazard way, like, or it seems haphazard at least. I know that there was a lot of attention and care put into the structure of this and the composition of this movie, but it just doesn't speak to you. It's kind of like the question of whether, you know, quality music is something that is new and does something that the medium hasn't seen before, or whether it can do something that the medium has seen before, maybe put a little twist on it, and make it really fun to listen to and vibe to, you know? I can't really vibe to this movie.
Oh, I mean, that's the joy of filmmaking, is it is such a subjective experience. And like, we all have different favorite Tarantino movies, and none of us are wrong. And like, whatever you guys think is their favorite as the audience, that's great. That's like, there's no one can tell you differently. And
unless your favorite's The Hateful Eight, nobody picks that.
Someone does. There's someone on this planet that's their favorite. And like,
I liked it.
I didn't, but whatever.
And they're right.
Yeah.
When they say that's the best Tarantino movie.
For them.
Yeah.
For them.
Well, that's something I want to talk about is postmodernism in cinema. And part of the reason why this movie is important is that it ushered in the era of postmodernism in cinema. And simply put, modernism is the idea that like there is answers to everything, that there is order to everything, and that through the scientific method and the empirical method, we can reach these conclusions. So that's right. Kind of the idea that, whereas postmodernism is kind of shucking this causality and
there's no such thing as no objective truth.
Totally. And so most films
embrace the void.
Yes. Most films are definitely modernist, where everything has causality. Everything is leading to something and everything has to pay off. There's Chekhov's gun. You show it. It has to go off in the third act. And this was kind of one of the first films to eschew that. And I think that's part of why it's got such a fantastic legacy, is that it ushered in the era, for films at least, of many movies kind of elevating past modernism and into postmodernism. And for film, I'm not going to talk about this too long, but the three...
Or sliding sideways at the very least.
The three elements of postmodern film are homage and pastiche, meta self-reference, and then bridging the gap between the highbrow and the lowbrow. And before this, there was postmodern films. Like, there was stuff like Taxi Driver or Blade Runner or Blazing Saddles or Unforgiven even a couple years before. But really after, like, there was five times more nonlinear films after Pulp Fiction made than there were before per year. There's like 10 times more postmodern films where it's talking about like more self-reference, more biting satire of the genre while still remaining in the genre. And so I think that's an important element to Pulp Fiction, is recognizing what an influence it's had and that it was really like one of the first movies to popularize that.
I think that's very valuable. I didn't really think about, I mean, I didn't watch this movie, you know, when it came out, right? I think I torrented this on my laptop in university in 2007 or 8 or whatever that was. And obviously at that point, I don't think I understood. I think rewatching it this time, I have understood a lot more about it and what makes it interesting and unique and special in the history of cinema. But I also don't like value things or value this film in particular just because it's kind of like going out there and taking a postmodern perspective. You know, I think that postmodern thought is a important aspect of any sort of healthy psychology, right? You have to understand that the world is chaotic, and in some ways nothing means anything. And so that's important to kind of hold in your mind. But at the same time, when I watch movies, I want there to be some sort of, but
this guy had a watch in his ass for 4 years.
He had a watch in his butt, yeah, for 4 years. Yeah, I think I would have. I mean, and I. This movie does have a bit of that, with Jules kind of like saying that at the end. And I do appreciate that the movie puts forward the two perspectives. Vincent's perspective is kind of like, hey man, like it was just, that wasn't a miracle. Like, it's just things happen, you know, like whatever. And Jules is like, no, this is means something. Like, oh, I'm gonna change my life because of this.
There you go. There's your themes right there. You got one guy who wants it to be modernist, and the other guy wants it to be postmodernist.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate that it gives you both the perspectives there.
So that's our show today, guys. Join us next week where we cover another movie that we don't know yet. I guess we're gonna do a poll and somebody can tell us.
Why don't we do a fun movie?
I think we wanted to do a fun one.
I want to do Scott Pilgrim. Can we just do Scott Pilgrim?
Too soon for another Edgar, yeah, Wright. No.
I'm not ready.
We'll have a poll on Twitter, and you guys can participate if you follow us at Carpool Critics, or you can email us carpoolcriticspodcast@gmail.com. Send us a bunch of criticism. We want to get better, so tell us how we suck.
Criticize the critics.
The podcast is all over the place.
It's talking over each other like I just did.
You like it to be this way instead of that way? Let us know, because we want to be the best movie podcast in the world.
Not just Finland.
Or Kenya.
We love you, Finland, though. Thanks for listening.
See you later.